Trump's delusional. That's the simplest thing I can say. He does not understand his own role in helping create this conflict. He added one country to NATO during his presidency. So he moved NATO east towards Russia, which is Russia's red line. They have, they put up for 26 years with the expansion of NATO to the east, despite multiple promises, not just from James Baker, but from other members of NATO at the time as well, like Genscher in Germany, that NATO would not expand to the east. And yet they broke that that promise. So that's the root cause for Russia. But Trump keeps acting like, Russia and Ukraine are like two kids fighting. They just don't like each other. I got to get in there and separate them, give them time out, put them in their corners. I mean, it's crazy. He thinks, the Russians just hate the Ukrainians. No, they don't. That's Trump sees this very much as like a personal thing between Vladimir Putin and Zelensky. It's not. Trump, right off the bat, doesn't understand. So he's going to pressure, or thinks he's going to pressure Putin into cease fire. And Putin's going to say, no, not going to happen. There's not going to be a, quote, cease fire. We will sit down and talk about the negotiations. But the first thing that must happen is Ukraine's got to vacate the four Russian provinces, because they are now Russia or Russian republics, are part of the Federation of Russian states. And, if they don't do that, then, we're not going to really have much more to talk about. But, that's what's on the table. I think Putin's going to make it very clear to Donald Trump that, what you're pushing for this unilateral ceasefire, basically, it's not going to happen. Now, Trump was on the phone with, Merz, Starmer, Macron, Tusk of Poland, and Maloney of Italy. And so no readout as far as what was said on that call. But I'm sure they said, hey, you got to insist on a ceasefire. Regardless, Trump's playing a very foolish game, because he's pretending as if the United States had no role at all in the buildup of the Ukrainian military, no role at all in bringing Ukraine as a de facto member of NATO, no role at all in targeting Russia. And, and since he's been president, he's continued to allow weapons to flow. So I think I'll be very, very surprised if both sides come out happy. I suspect Trump's going to come out and condemn Putin as a problem. Trump, the optimism, I held, I didn't really believe it strongly, but I was hopeful that Trump would seize the opportunity to, one, end the war in Ukraine and reach a peace deal with Iran. None of that's going to happen. Trump keeps saying some very, very stupid things with respect to what's going on in the world. He doesn't understand.
Here is, Larry, what former Defense Secretary Robert Gates suggested in terms of, he said that Donald Trump is not ready for a personal meeting with Vladimir Putin. And here is the reason he mentioned about it.
Trump not to take that face-to-face, even if Vladimir Putin was willing to do it?
I would say you need to figure out some leverage that you have going into that meeting with Putin. What can you do that puts more pressure to bear on Putin to make him believe his his interests are served by not just a ceasefire, but a basically at least freezing things in place.
What type
don't get me going on Bob Gates. I mean, look, he was the director of intelligence when I was an analyst. He's a liar. He is dishonest. He is a manipulator of intelligence. I witnessed it firsthand. One of my buddies was the South African analyst, a guy named John Reed, and the request came from the White House. We want to know if Nelson Mandela is a communist, and so John, you know, wrote the response back. You know, well, Nelson Mandela has relationships or friendships or associations with these different people who are communists. Nelson Mandela is not a communist. Bob Gates edited that piece. He only took out one little word. Let's see if you can guess what word he took out, Nima. Huh? You're muted.
He's not a communist. He's
not. He took out not.
So, just removed the not.
So Nelson Mandela is a communist. That's Bob Gates. Now, Gates is again delusional. Yeah, we got to find that leverage over Putin. We don't have leverage over Vladimir Putin. Period. Those days are over. We're either going to agree to Russia's terms, which ultimately means NATO's got to back the hell off, or we're going to risk going to war with Russia, because Russia's going to militarily destroy Ukraine and in the process eviscerate NATO. That's simple. People need to understand it. That's, you know, if Putin sort of, if he said, oh yeah, yeah, you're right, Mr. Trump, we'll stop where we are. We won't go any farther, and we'll trust you. The Russians have been, they've been down that road already with us. They recognize you cannot trust the United States to keep any agreement. We've walked away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty agreement. Trump walked away from the intermediate nuclear forces agreement. Name one agreement that the United States has kept its word on. From the Russian perspective, that would be zero, none.
Larry, these people who are pushing for more leverage to be possessed by Donald Trump on Putin, here is one of the main goals of these people. And it seems that they're pushing so much from the U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. Here is what he said.
To impose sanctions against Russia.
Well, I think we will see what happens when both sides get to the table. President Trump has made it very clear that if President Putin does not negotiate in good faith, that the United States will not hesitate to up the Russia sanctions along with our European partners. What I can tell you is the sanctions were very ineffective during the Biden administration because they kept them low because they were afraid of pushing up domestic oil prices.
Larry, you see the same strategy in Yemen. They came to power to say, no, Joe Biden didn't fight Yemenis the way that we are able.
He was weak. He was weak. We're gonna be tough. Oh.
I've seen the same story.
Look, the United States and Russia share one thing in common. Both countries are rich in natural resources. Both countries are capable of feeding themselves without having to rely upon anyone on the outside. And both countries have all of the energy resources that they need to meet their domestic demand. But, you know, the United States has opted to import some. But if you had to build a wall around each country and say which country would survive, Russia is the one that would survive. Russia doesn't need trade with other countries in order to stay alive. The United States does. The United States, in terms of its trade relations with Mexico, Canada, and China, we're really very dependent upon China for a lot of the consumer items. But when you look at the issue of debt, that is the, you know, that's where it really starts to come apart for the United States. Russia's debt is about 14 to 20% of its gross domestic product. The United States debt is 125% of our gross domestic product, and it's getting worse with each passing day. You know, people like Besant, they're just arrogant and ignorant of Russia. They think, oh, all we got to do is really put the Russia's economy's weak. Well, I started hearing that and I started looking up some facts. In 1995, 7% of Russian citizens were considered in the middle class. Okay? That means you're looking at like 90% of the country in lower middle class in some form of poverty. Today, that number is around 50%. Quite a dramatic turnaround in 30 years. In the United States, the number that were considered middle class in 1995 were around between 55 and 60%. Now that number's at 51%. So in the what's happening in the United States, instead of the middle class growing, instead of people becoming wealthier, it's going in reverse. And yet the United States continues to say, oh, we're the best. Oh, we're so much better than everybody else. Oh, yeah, look at the literacy rates. In the United States, 54% of the population read at the sixth grade level or lower. Okay, our current literacy rate is like 74%. In Russia, it's 97%. So, you know, start picking out markers in terms of which country can produce hypersonic weapons, hypersonic missiles that actually work in combat. Oh, that'd be Russia. United States has yet to produce one. Russia's got at least three. So this... the United States is indulging this fantasy of we're so good. You know, it's like the evil queen was in Snow White, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all? Just because you keep looking at yourself and you've told the mirror, you tell me I'm the fairest, so I'm going to break you. Okay, yeah, you're the fairest. You're the best. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's I actually say the relationship's not that complicated. It's pretty simple. The United States is locked in a delusional state. We believe things about ourselves that are just not true. And at the same thing, we believe things about Russia that are not true. And those false beliefs lead us to make decisions that later, you know, they blow up on us.
Do you think that it's so important, Larry, to put ourselves in the shoes of those people who are pushing for more leverage on the part of the West and Russia. But in your opinion, beyond sanctions, is there anything that comes to their mind that would be substantial for Russia?
No, well, they again, they believe all we got to do is, you know, prevent Russia from earning money off of oil and natural gas. And they assume that in that they're going to pressure India and China. In fact, I was just listening to Carolyn Leavitt. She had held a press conference this morning that started a little after 9 a.m. on the East Coast. And she persists with this mythology of, oh, yeah, we put those tariffs on China, and, man, they came running. They came, boy, they were hurting. They came to us. It proves Donald Trump was right. Well, it's just nonsense. That's not what happened. It was the United States that called China. Hey, can we talk, please? I said, okay. What do we talk about? We'll cut that tariff back to 30%. And China said, okay, well, we'll do the same. We're going to treat you like you treat us. But I haven't seen anything in the press to show that China said, oh, and those bans we imposed on the rare earth minerals, we're lifting those. We're going to give those to you so you can build more weapons that you can attack us with. I didn't see China do that. And China is doing other things. They used to send a lot of students to the United States, and those students paid a lot of money, making U.S. colleges profit. Chinese have pulled the plug on that. And so there are a lot of U.S. schools that are really suffering because they don't have those Chinese students around anymore. That's number one. From just an intelligence standpoint, I maintain one of the reasons the United States did that over the years and encouraged the Chinese students to come was so CIA could actually target, try to recruit people that would go back to China and become cooperators of the CIA. So now, we're busy making that impossible for the Chinese to come here too in some respects. So it just, when you put this entire picture together, it's just, you've got a White House that's just out of touch with reality.
I think Vladimir Putin was very honest and forthright with Donald Trump about the reality that currently exists. And it's not a good reality for Ukraine. It's a very bad reality for Ukraine. But I think Putin, rather than being arrogant and forceful, respect. First of all, I think he respects the fact that Donald Trump is committed to peace. Let's never forget that the previous administration just wasn't talking to the Russians. The last time Biden spoke with Putin was in Geneva in June of 2021, where he prefaced the meeting by calling Putin a killer. And then he lied to Putin, wasn't honest about anything. Here we have an American president who's taking political risks. The easiest thing in the world politically for Donald Trump to do is to continue, given the amount of Russophobia that exists in the United States, given the support that he'd get from Europe, and then the ego boost he'd get from the Ukrainians, calling them a hero, it would be to continue the policies of Biden or even, improve upon them. I don't think the American people would reject this. I think if it was sold properly, the American people would fall in behind because they've been conditioned to be anti-Russian. But Trump is going against the grain. He's taking the hardest possible path. And it's a difficult path. I mean, some people like myself would like him to be more forceful in putting pressure on Ukraine. But we have to remember that there's a lot of political obstacles here that have to be overcome. It's easy for somebody sitting, hundreds of miles away from Washington, D.C. to say, get out of NATO and tell the Europeans to pound sand and withdraw your embassies and tell Congress this. But that's not the real world. The real world we live in is far more complicated. And Trump has to navigate all of this in the pursuit of trying to bring an end to the conflict in a way that is beneficial to Russia and the United States, because that's one of the things that Trump emphasizes all the time, is that this isn't about continuing to bring Russia down, that he's actually trying to create a better life for Russia and the United States and the world. And I think Putin respects this tremendously, because I think Putin understands the political risks that Donald Trump takes. And so Putin is working with Trump to make a negotiated settlement possible, but it's only going to be possible based upon the Russian reality. There is no other reality. And I think Putin's task in talking to Trump is to educate him. The Russians have been very honest with Steve Witkoff. Witkoff has come back and spoken about the Russian reality. When the Russians spoke to Rubio and Waltz before he was fired, they both came out and said there's a Russian reality, that we have to address the Russian reality. So the Russians have been, you know, very successful in communicating this, but the other players aren't up to the task of standing up to the pressure. Rubio goes to Europe and then bends to the will of Europe to start articulating things that indicate an exhaustion with this peace process. You know, yes, Europe wants Trump to be exhausted by this so that he then withdraws from it and then supports Europe's policies and supports Ukraine. They're trying to suck him into, you know, continuing Biden's policies. I think Putin is appreciative of the fact that Donald Trump has shown an ability to withstand that. But what's essential here is that Putin has to reaffirm in Trump's mind, you know, some essential truths that sometimes get watered down by Marco Rubio or Scott Bessent or, you know, Keith Kellogg and other people who don't have peaceful coexistence with Russia first and foremost on their mind. And they also need to put steel in the spine of people like J.D. Vance and Tulsi Gabbard and even Steve Witkoff, people who I think are on the right side, but falter in the face of opposition. And one of the reasons why they falter is that Donald Trump himself is all over the map, you know, saying this one day, saying that the other day. A conversation with Vladimir Putin, I mean, that you are literally speaking to the source. And it helps strengthen Donald Trump. It empowers Donald Trump to say, I spoke with Putin for 2 hours. I know what Putin thinks, as opposed to relying on the interpretation from other people. So I think this phone call was invaluable, and it creates the possibility, because I think one of the things that's going to happen on this phone call is that Trump is going to wait a couple weeks. There was no pressure on Putin to stop the war, and I think the battlefield is evolving in a way that just is to the detriment of Ukraine on a daily basis, and the Russians are taking the current reality and, you know, improving it from the Russian perspective and, you know, putting the Ukrainians in a far worse position. So the longer this war goes on, the weaker Ukraine becomes, and the more apparent, the longer the United States avoid decisive engagement on behalf of Ukraine, the more difficult it becomes for Europe to pretend that they have the ability to step in and fill the gap. And maybe, just maybe, Ukraine will wake up to the reality that the best deal they have is the one that's on the table today. And that if they continue to wait much longer, as the Russians insinuated, we won't be talking about four oblasts that are part of Russia. We'd be talking about eight. And the other thing that people need to understand about Russia is that, you know, there's that old saying, slow to harness, fast to ride. you know, the Russians, you know, aren't putting a lot of demands out there. They, you know, everything they've done, they've been compelled to do in a cause-effect relationship that has them reacting to actions taken by Ukraine and their Western supporters. Here, Russia is now getting ready to become proactive in moving forward to, you know, assert its demands and ensure that they're put out. The Ukrainians need to understand that the game is changing. The day of Ukraine being able to have any say whatsoever at the negotiating table is rapidly coming to an end. And soon what's going to happen is Ukraine will be in a position where their only role is to accept the dictation of unconditional surrender that will be imposed on them by a victorious Russia.
Donald Trump, and the way he said right after the call, he said that the two parties should talk to each other and make some sort of solution. But do you think that he's willing to leave the... He tried to be somehow mediating the talks between the two parties. Right now, he's just withdrawing from that position. Or if that's the case, what is the reason for that? Is that the pressure coming from Europe? Is that the way that Zelensky was manipulated by Europeans to play against him? What's going on in that term?
Well, I think half the problem is that Donald Trump's team is decisively split on the issue of, you know, what peace with Russia would look like. You know, Marco Rubio, you know, claims that he is the servant of the president, but when Marco Rubio's allowed off leash, he says things that are less than enthusiastic about the betterment of relations between the United States and Russia. Keith Kellogg just has no desire to have good relations between the two nations, and yet he is still the special envoy to Ukraine. And Scott Benson, all he wants to do is sanction Russia. Really, he wakes up every morning saying, how can I sanction Russia? Give me an excuse to sanction Russia. He's not looking for the betterment of relations. As the Secretary of Treasury, he should be looking for, you wake up every morning saying, how can we expand economic relations with Russia? That should be his goal. But Steve Witkoff has taken that, you know, that space, because Witkoff seems to be the primary interlocutor between, you know, the United States and Kirill Dmitriev, who is a Russian economist, is now heavily involved in this. This suggests, and based upon the conversation that Trump had with Putin, you know, there's a heavy economic component to this dialogue that goes beyond the Ukraine conflict. But in short, all the economic potential that Trump, I believe, wants to put on the table, it can't happen until there's a resolution to this conflict. And Trump's problem is that he has a team that's decisively split. Even the people on his side are tentative, not fully committed, hesitant. And so this plays to Europe and Ukraine, who are able to cherry pick Trump's advisors to put pressure. And then, you know, they can weaken the resolve of those who, you know, like J.D. Vance and Tulsi and Witkoff, who are supportive. But, you know, now they're like, oh, gosh, where's Trump? I mean, what are we going to do about NATO? You know, are we divorcing from NATO? Are we going to reinforce NATO, stand strong with NATO? I have to be careful what I say here. So they fall back on old talking points. And I just think the Europeans and Ukrainians have been playing America in the best way possible. They know which strings to pull because they've been pulling them for decades. Trump is the one guy whose strings you can't pull. And so I think what you're going to see now is that Trump is going to start engaging directly, decisively with Europe and Ukraine, especially Zelensky. I think you're going to see Trump putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Zelensky. And, you know, I think this might be part of the Russian goal, because, you know, here's Putin speaking positively about Trump, speaking about the need to respect the process, that the Russians are going to work on, you know, a draft treaty that details everything. And Zelensky's just saying, no, 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 no. And I think what Trump is going to do is going to identify the problem as Zelensky and then put pressure on Europe. And if Europe can't get Zelensky to change, to say, I'm done, walk away, but not walk away in a way that gives a green light to Bessent to put sanctions on or, you know, allows Rubio to begin aid. Walk away saying Europe and Ukraine are on their own. Putin, talk to me when it's over, kind of thing. So, because I do think that at the end of the day, Trump wants better relations with Russia. And if Trump recognizes that the impediment to peace isn't named Vladimir Putin, but rather Volodymyr Zelensky or, you know, Macron or Merz or any of these Europeans, then, you know, that brings clarity to this issue.
You've mentioned the division within the administration, Vance, and together with Tulsi Gabbard. On the other hand, you mentioned Rubio and Keith Kellogg. Here is what Vance said in terms of the way that he sees Vladimir Putin and his proposals.
Is Vladimir Putin serious about negotiating peace, right? He has made some concessions. He has taken some serious steps in these conversations, but we feel like, you know, we're at a point where we're hitting an impasse, and that's why the president is talking to him on the phone. Yeah, I think honestly that President Putin, he doesn't quite know how to get out of the war. If you think about this, he's got 1 million men under arms. He's re-engineered his entire economy. What used to be manufacturing facilities making, you know, products for people to use in their civilian life, they're now making tank shells and artillery shells and drones. And so this is a little bit of guess, but I think the president would agree that part of this is, I'm not sure that Vladimir Putin has a strategy himself for how to unwind the war, of course, that's been going on for a few years now. And I think there's also just a little bit of, look, there's fundamental mistrust.
If I were to mention one of the most honest characters in the current administration, I would say J.D. Vance, because he's so optimistic, he's trying to do something. But what is the source of this information that Vladimir Putin doesn't have a strategic plan to deal with Ukraine?
It comes from a very shallow assessment of the facts. I mean, nothing that, the conclusions that Vance drew are conclusions, speculative in nature. You know, but the bottom line is Russia has engineered a very successful war economy. They have a defense industry now that is outpacing Europe and the United States combined. And that's a reality. And there are economic consequences to this in terms of workforce allocation, resource allocation. You get an overheated economy, it leads to higher inflation. I mean, Russia's going through all of these issues. But, and so what Vance's talk reflects is that he's spoken to an economist, maybe somebody in Treasury, maybe somebody in the CIA, that's getting a very simplistic economic overview. But you need to go deeper, because the key to this isn't, you know, what you see on the surface, it's what's happening underneath. The meetings that Putin has with his economic team, with his national the state council, the meetings he has with various governors about economic development. And when you take that deep dive, and trust me, I take that deep dive every single week. Every time Putin leaves Moscow and travels around Russia, you know, he's meeting with governors, he's meeting with economic leaders. And that's where you learn about what's going on in Russia. You know, one of the whole ideas behind the 2020 constitutional embrace of the state council was that Putin is planning on pushing the governance of the Russian Federation out of exclusively Moscow down to the governors and the different oblasts or regions. That was the strategic vision behind that. I don't think Vance was told that, by the way. I don't even think he understands that. If I talk to him about the 2020 constitution referendum in Russia and the role of the state council and other reforms that are made, he'd just look at me blankly. But it's the job of the CIA to put everything into perspective. But see, so these meetings, they have gravitas, they mean something. And so you listen to the conversations. First of all, by doing that, you understand that, yes, the military economy is very important. And yes, getting things up to speed. It's not just about Ukraine, though. Understand that because of the behavior of NATO and the United States, Russia made a strategic decision to expand its military from 900,000 to 1.5 million outside of the framework of the special military operation. So when you put up, when you create a 70,000 strong, new core-sized element in the newly formed St. Petersburg military district, where do the weapons come from? You know, they come from the factories that have to produce these weapons. And once you produce weapons, understand this. The weapons you allocate for that core are the weapons that they begin conflict with. But the Russians now know that when you engage in high-intensity conflict, you're going to be eating through equipment. So the Russians are building equipment to equip that core, plus replacement equipment that goes into depots throughout the country, staged. You need a fully functioning defense industry to do this in a timely fashion. And so Russia has a plan for this. And I think Vance is misreading that plan, not understanding, you know, that the Russians do have a plan to produce and then tone down. The Russians, I think, in some of these conversations that I've monitored, you know, they're talking about beginning the drawdown from a war-type economy in 2027. Even if the war ended today, they would continue for another 2 years because they have to produce this equipment to build to fully, you know, equip these new units that they're building from 900,000 to 1.5 million. And again, because they understand that once you engage in combat, you may not have time to get that defense industry up and running immediately. You've got to have replacement equipment on hand. So they're building the reserves. Russia's ready for whatever comes at it. And that's what their defense economy is doing. And the Russians have made a strategic decision to accept the consequences of this with a plan to mitigate and draw down. There's a genius behind the Russian economy. This is why their economy still grows despite sanctions. This is why there's nothing the West could do to deter. I mean, the whole concept of sanctions was to ensure that Russia couldn't do what it's doing today. You know, to have this economic potential turned into military industrial potential. Russia's done this despite the best efforts by the West to strangle them economically and prevent this. And while Russia has done this, they've grown their civilian economic sphere so that the people in Russia have good paydays. They have lots of stuff on the shelf. They're well fed, good standard of living. I don't think J.D. Vance understands anything about Russia. That was a very superficial take, and I can't blame him. He's the vice president. He has, you know, his domestic responsibilities, but I blame the people who brief him, because what he was saying is an absolutely incomplete and inaccurate vision of the reality of Russia's economic state.
And who's briefing him, in your opinion?
Well, I imagine it's the same briefing that President Trump gets in terms of the DNI. If you remember, Ray McGovern, who I believe you know very well, Ray used to brief the president, but I think he was also the vice president. He was the briefer of George H.W. Bush when he was the vice president. That's the same briefing. He gets the president's daily brief, the Fed. So Vance is being briefed. Now, Vance has the ability, as any national level decision maker, to ask follow-on questions. And since Vance probably has more time than the president, because he's backing him up as opposed to taking the lead, you know, Vance might be able to ask more detailed questions and get more detailed follow-on briefings. I don't know. I'm not privy to that process. I'm just speculating here. But, you know, at a minimum, he's getting what the president gets, and probably getting more based upon the questions and the fact that the president has handed off certain policy portfolio priorities to Vance, for Vance to be involved and engaged in. So Vance will want to become even, you know, better briefed on that. But, you know, the there's a whole, again, there's the theory of, CIA or DNI briefings, which is, you know, apolitical. We give them what's necessary. And then there's the reality. I mean, the briefer knows that if you come in with stuff that the briefee, the customer doesn't want, their eyes roll and they shut it down, and you lost connectivity. So you bring in things that will catch their attention, that are designed to be readily absorbed, to make yourself even more relevant. And what happens is you often sacrifice accuracy for, you know, the reasonable goal of maintaining connectivity. You want the vice president or the president to look forward to the briefing. You want them to be receptive to the briefing. In order to do that, you've got to play a little game in terms of making the product digestible. You're inviting the president to a restaurant, the food better taste good. If you invite him to a restaurant and you put bad taste in food in front of them, president can be looking for people who are going to start sugarcoating things. So there's a little bit of sugarcoating going on in all the intelligence that's given to people. Plus, they're still trying to figure out this president. Where does he stand on issues? Because he literally is all over the board sometimes on certain things. Israel and Gaza. One day, Israel can do whatever they want. Next day, they need to stop. It's bad. Now you're the briefer going, what am I supposed to brief? So I just think that, it comes from the DNI, but like I said, J.D. Vance probably has the ability to ask for more detailed follow-on briefings that, they can start bringing in subject matter experts, and then there should be some question and answer, but no intelligence manager likes to bring in the analyst. I'll tell you that from experience, because the intelligence manager wants to be the hero. The intelligence manager wants the person to be the person with the FaceTime. And the problem is, once you bring in the analyst to the principal, and the principal see who really is the brains of this operation, the principal keeps asking for the analyst, and the intelligence manager just pushed aside. So, that's the other half of the problem, is there's just politics and the whole business of intelligence careerism as well.